Greetings. Welcome to Confessing the Blues. I'm your host, Jim Ange Anderson. On today's show, we welcome multi-instrumentalist, a stalwart on the Chicagoland blues scene, Mr. Jeff, his friends call him Wally Walworth. Let's roll! Wally, welcome to the Farmhouse Studios.
Thank you. Pleasure.
Yeah, well, you got a brand new record out, North South. Can you talk about the record?
Well, sure. It's a blues, rock, jazz. I don't like labels that much, but it's a blues record that's supposed to be like a journey down to the Delta, down to New Orleans and back. So it's kind of supposed to touch on a few different bags and be the equivalent of a road trip down south and back. So the record's called North South.
Musical journey.
Musical journey.
And you've written some songs on here as well as played some covers?
Yeah. I've opened it up with Chicken Shack. In fact, the original idea for me was to kind of use it like bookends, like opening and closing a set. And then I did a song by my brother Applejack, wrote Move to Petaluma, which is sort of got some humorous lyrics. A couple originals, the Norfolk Light Artillery Blues. I liked it. It's sort of a rock blues mix. Blues is in everything. You don't consciously plan to make something sound bluesy. Wally's Mambo is just an original, sort of a tribute to Professor Longhair or that down south boogie, and so forth. Did some covers, so there's three, four originals on there, and I tried to touch on a little bit of R&B or jazz organ, and then always blues is in everything there, and it's supposed to, like I say, be a little journey. Or musically, there's the full production numbers are connected by short keyboard numbers with or without the drummer. So I always tell people, well, just throw it in there, and it's good on the road, and if you don't like one, skip to the next, because it covers, 15 tunes in 62 minutes or something. So,
the first time I heard it, I enjoyed it from beginning to end. Sometimes you get a new CD, and you hear a song, you're like, I like that, and you hear the second song, you're like, well, let's see what the third one is. And I really enjoyed, I think you covered it from, like you said, end to end. It's
beautiful.
A good record.
Well, I'm glad it worked like that. You always see things in hindsight. I could have done this, should have done that, but then go and do another one.
There you go. Wally's Mambo, I really enjoyed that. Can you talk about that one?
Yeah, that actually was one and done, one take. My brother's on the drums on a few of the cuts, and he's so talented, but he, a bit of a hermit, my brother Greg. He's a super talented drummer. But anyway, he agreed to do some tunes. So he's like, I got to go. I got to get home. It's getting late. And he's like putting his coat on. And I'm like, no, wait, one more. Let me try this. And we just jumped down and no discussion and nailed it.
Thank you. maybe talk a little bit about your family. You have a musical family. There was a lot of music in the household when you were growing up.
Absolutely. I mean, everybody humming and whistling. Or my dad was a whistler when he would do projects and so forth. But my mom, I think my brothers think my mom had most of the talent. She would sing, you know, sing in church and played piano. And so you're exposed to piano music and, you know, whatever your folks were listening to, you know, Pete Fountain, Dixieland, you know, Al Hurt, all that stuff from the early 60s and so forth. And, you know, singing in church and Christmas carols and just corny, you know, starting out with folk songs and traditional songs. And then with everybody from your parents and your older brothers, you're exposed to the rock and roll, the Beatles, the Stones, the blues, everything. So I just was exposed to music all the time. There's a piano in the living room, and I start plunking out on the piano, plunking out songs. You know, 4 or 5 years old, I could pick out melodies. So it was a gift.
So your brother Greg lives in the area?
Yeah, he's in Lowell now, and we do get together and play some jazz. He's a drummer first, but he's taken up the keyboard, and he'll come over and we'll do two keyboards or get him on the drums some, and then I can play the sax when he gets on the piano. So we still get together in Woodshed, you know, practice our brains out when we get together. It goes in such a session that the wives finally say, you better wrap this.
time to
wrap this up, you know. Why don't you go home? But, yeah, so, of course, Applejack, my oldest brother, he played harp and he writes and, like, guitar and anything he could get his hands on. I'm similar like that. You'll just try anything. If you like the sound, pleases you, you're intrigued by the instrument. Cigar box guitar and everything from there on out.
Right. And yeah. He's in the Bay Area?
Yeah, he's in the Bay Area, Applejack, Walrath, and...
And he's done some recording and...
Oh, absolutely. He still writes and plays. He does a lot of duos and coffee house type gigs and then plays with big combos, whoever call him. And he does work with Buzz Skaggs now and then. He's written some tunes for him, which is quite a nice credential. And so he's a good writer and harp player first, but he will plunk around on a keyboard. He can sit and play the guitar and sing, play blues, you know, old Delta type blues. With all that picking going on and stuff, you know, picking out the bass and so forth.
Nice.
A lot of open chords and that. But anyway, so he was a major influencer. He left home and made it playing blues. And so, you know, somewhere in the 60s or late 60s, I realized that you could make a living playing music. And that germ was planted at that time, you know. But so then you got to turn on to him with Elvin Bishop, that first record. I think it was 69 or something. And right in there... Muddy Waters, we were teeny boppers. We had exposed to all the hits, stuff like may have said Beatles and Stones and all that stuff. The Cream was heavy blues. And so we were like Beatle freaks at 8, 10 years old, me and my best friend and my brothers. Weren't we all?
Sure.
And the blues and the rock and roll, Chuck Berry, it's in everything, you know. And so then you're exposed to that, and I'd get turned on to a few key records like the Fathers and Son records by Muddy Waters. So I discovered in the 60s that the blues was rather hip, and then over the years discovered the earlier stuff, you know, and studied more piano music and so forth. But, you know, like I said, Johnny Winter, the Rolling Stones, there was so much rock and roll that was based in the blues, Ray Charles and that. And so all my older brothers playing records all the time, even Slim Harpo, my brother Mark had that record and about wore it out and didn't realize how hip it was till many years later, you know. So, and then Greg was a drummer, and he was in the band programs and everything, and he was always playing. See, if you love your music, you didn't have to be told to practice.
Right.
You were always playing, either listening to music or making music. And he did all that stuff. He was a few years ahead of me, so he had a combo or a garage band or a neighborhood band, and they did like Herb Alpert and The Ventures and Walk Don't Run and all that bag and whatever was on the radio. But he turned me on to, like, that sort of horn band thing, you know, with, like, Blood, Sweat, and Tears, the Mad Dogs and the Englishmen, mm-hmm. Chicago, and all that. And so he was in the band program, and he had concert band and marching band and jazz band and all that. And so he taught me really about rhythm, about how important it was to keep time and to be a dedicated musician. So between Applejack and Greg, there was some pedigree or there was some serious music going on. So, but I was odd. You know, a lot of kids, they say, Jimmy, get in here and practice your piano.
Yeah.
I was like, I'd be playing 2, 3, 4 hours all afternoon. And finally, my mom would say, why don't you go out and play?
Right,
you know,
right.
So you don't turn it off. I mean, it's a gift. It's a germ. It's an affliction, which I'm glad I have.
You mentioned your brother Mark. Is Mark a musician as well?
Well, he was more casual, him and Phil, but they had all the records, and they were turning me on. You're coming home from college or whatever, they were turning me on to all the stuff as it came out. You know, Dylan, Leon Russell, Jimi Hendrix, All that stuff. So really, by the time I was 10 or 12, I had a pretty good knowledge of what was hip or what was going on. You know, I'm just saying I was very fortunate to have a musical family, and being the last boy of five, you were exposed to tons
sure.
of tons,
I was
of music.
The fifth of six boys.
Yeah, you
so
see.
So I had the same, listened to all the same music, you know, and came by it naturally.
Like, I dug Hit the Road Jack as a tyke, and I didn't know who Ray Charles was, but I knew I loved that.
You like that song.
Loved that stuff.
Yeah. So you're talking about being 10 years old and having all this music in your head. When did you actually start to play an instrument?
Well, I started on piano about five, somewhere in there, either side of kindergarten. They decided to send me to lessons with the local neighborhood teacher, Mrs. McKee, you know, and you'd have to prepare your lesson and stuff. And I think we all blew off some of our homework, if you will, but started out with that. And meanwhile, you're exposed to rock and roll and learning to plunk out melodies. So I had about 10 years, somewhere in there, and, you know, I don't know, 12, 13, somewhere in there, got a very challenging and talented teacher named Iris Zahara out of Flossmoor, and she played an organ in church and concert piano and organ. She was awesome, and she pushed the heck out of me to learn, you know, classical Bach and all that. And I did about 10 years of lessons. But meanwhile, I had the fortunate enough to have the gift to play by ear, so I'm picking up rock and roll and pop music at the same time. And I think about the time I discovered, you know, Leon Russell and Jerry Lee Lewis and Muddy Waters and stuff, Rolling Stones. It was kind of obvious that I was going to play rock and blues.
So that was like the aha moment. Like,
It was. In fact, in about the fourth or fifth grade, one of my buddies in the neighborhood lived next door to the piano teacher, and he had a song called The Blues, or Basin Street Blues, but it was not that complicated. It was a 12-bar blues on the piano, and I heard him playing it. He said, "Try this, Wally," or something. I looked at, sat down and played it, and it was like, then played it for about 20, 30 minutes, or immediately started to improvise on it on a 12-bar in C. That was really, maybe, I think, the aha moment.
Can you talk about some of your influences on the piano?
Getting turned on to Muddy Waters and stuff, he had Pine Top and Otis Spann, Otis Spann, a Chicago guy, I believe. And so getting turned on to the blues, I listened to them quite a bit without even knowing who they were until you started to dig a little deeper. But so, and then blues guys, and of course, Applejack had that Elvin Bishop record, and we about wore that out. And he had Stephen Miller on organ and piano. And so I think he was an influence, and I didn't even realize it till you go back 20 years later and listen to the record and say, oh, that's where I got that lick. Mm-hmm. Like you said, you don't really think about consciously about why you play certain notes. And so those were the blues guys. And then with the rock and roll and the pop music, my older brother Mark had a reel-to-reel, and he put the headphones. He says, listen to this. And he put on Leon Russell, Stranger in a Strange Land. And I'm like, oh, wow. Or I heard some stuff. I didn't know. I couldn't pull off what he was doing, but I could recognize that it was, you know, country, rock, pop, blues. It was all really there.
Yeah.
There was nothing that complicated, but it was so much feel and color to it. So Leon Russell and, of course, like Jerry Lee Lewis, the rock and roll, yeah. And I could do that. Because when we were in the 60s and around 1970, you get a combo going. You did Beatles, Stones, but you did Chuck Berry.
And
you
even
did some rock and roll, yeah. Some stuff like Rock Around the Clock and that. If you think about it, we were still doing 50s music when we got going playing gigs.
That was before 50s was oldies. Right?
Yeah, yeah. You know, so a lot of rock and roll.
I hear some Professor Longhair in
Absolutely. Yeah. See, now that was a little later. That was probably, you know, late 70s or 80s where I really started to dig into the old Barrel House players and the Delta guys and the Dance, and I love New Orleans music, so it was like a natural for me. My folks loved Dixieland and danced and like Pete Fountain and all that. They would go down there, and the first time I was down there, it was just a complete eye opener, you know. But Professor Long, Dr. John, actually, again, older brother, Applejack, Mark, they had Dr. John records, and I'm like, this guy is nuts.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, he's very good, but you'd see all the headdresses and the Chipatula Indians and all that stuff, and you're like, wow. But the music was there. You can't just have a gimmick if you can't play, you know. So Dr. John records, and then Professor Longhair, because you hear a song, Tipitina, and you got to find out who wrote it as you do your research and so forth. But yeah, Longhair, his stuff is so cool. So I think they affected my style. Again, you don't plan out that I want to sound like this, but you hear stuff that moves you, and then you're going to go analyze it and try to be able to pick it up on your instrument. And then eventually, if you're lucky, you start to sound like the guy. In fact, I remember getting picked up and playing blues with Applejack and a few guys like Steve Cook and Johnny Young. And these guys were, they knew I played piano. And I don't know, maybe it was about 8th, 9th grade. I definitely wasn't driving. And they'd pick us all up in a large four-door or a station wagon, throw everybody's stuff in the car and go play either a coffee house or go play somebody's backyard and mark them and stuff. And that was a real eye-opener. You know, people drinking out of styrofoam cups and stuff and being exposed to all that.
Sure.
Know? But still, the music was so cool. I was so lucky to be thrown in there. Yeah, he can't grow whiskers, but he can play piano. So we'll take him along.
You made it, you know?
I made it. In fact, Johnny Young, he played, box guitar, electric guitar, and mandolin.
Right.
And I don't know. I probably met him through Applejack or Steve Cook. Some of these blues guys, white blues guys, introduced me to black blues guys. And it was awesome. And we actually did some coffee houses, or we worked together about a year.
So I think the first time that I'd met you, you were playing with Little Whitey and the Castle Rockers.
Oh, yeah.
Can you talk about that whole experience?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, Whitey and I, in about the 7th grade, or like I said, some of those first combos that were guys from the neighborhood and you didn't necessarily have gigs, he'd come over, and I used to have to tune his guitar. He had, luckily, like I said, a lot of it is a gift. I had an ear, and I could tell. So, your B string's out of tune or whatever. So I used to have to tune his guitar back in the early days. And then later on, he just took off and way beyond me, really, with studying the blues. So we were in a combo called Little Wally and the Burnouts.
Oh, wow.
In about 71 or 72. And anyway, later on, he went down to Carbondale and immersed himself in the blues. And when he came back in the 80s, we hooked back up. And, of course, it was a natural fit. And I could just see, I respected how much he did his homework. you know, and it paid off for him. Like I said, he used to just struggle, and I'd have to show him parts or tune his guitar, and then 10, 15 years down the pike, he's got the stuff down. In fact, Whitey, to me, was one of the best harmonica player I'd ever worked with. Just so true to guys like Little Walter and James Cotton and all those cats that were doing it right, you know, Junior Wells and everything. He had the tone, and it's not just your sound, it's your the note selection. It's
right.
what you leave out as much as what you put in. So we hooked back up in the 80s, and he would play guitar and harp and sing, and I would play piano, and I never had an organ as such hauling around a Hammond B3. I had organ facsimiles, you know, a synthesizer that had a few good organ sounds, or a decent organ sound, but I had something with a rotating speaker like a Cordovox or something. So I would play piano, organ, and sax. So really early on, I've always had a lot of colors, I think, are a lot to offer. So we did all that stuff, and, you know, of course, the Muddy Waters and the Pine Top and the James Cotton and the traditional stuff. But then we got the Thunderbirds were so big, and Stevie Ray. And for a while there, I'd say, I don't know, early to mid-80s, we did tons of Thunderbirds. But then in the 90s, he, like, abandoned all that or refused to play it. Like, everybody's playing that, or I'm not going to.
Right.
So the repertoire went, like, heavy on a Texas guitar or heavy on guitar blues. And it went back to Chicago, or more traditional. We went back to the roots, like the Little Walter.
He played some mean slide guitar, Elmer James, that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Absolutely. So he I think we both had a dedication to music, but he kind of showed me, do the homework. Or listen, you can never listen to enough records. Just go home and listen to records, you know. Even Bruce Feldgen brought that up. I respect when this guy can tell you, oh, he wrote that, or that's on that old record, you remember? Or that's on our Hooli. He mentioned some label.
Yeah.
And so these guys, you should always be picking up not just musical chops, but knowledge and names and influences and record companies. You should be. You can learn something from everybody, you know.
Do your homework, do your research.
Yep, and every day you get up. You know, I read somewhere, probably Facebook or something, but a real musician or a true musician, you're either making music or you're planning on making music.
Yeah.
You're playing a song, or you're thinking about the next song you're going to play. So you don't just turn it off. It's there all the time.
You can't help it.
No.
Right?
So with Whitey, we got back together and we played a lot of gigs in the 80s and 90s. So we had it going on. Unfortunately, you know, he had a monkey on his back and he couldn't quite shake it, and we lost another guy there. So that kind of broke my heart, losing Little Whitey.
Sure.
Because I grew up with him. He had older brothers. I had older brothers. We used to, you know, there's fights that break out between the Hillview,
right,
the Hillview boys and the Birch boys, or the Evergreen guys and the guys on the next block over. You know, there's certain little cliques that didn't jibe. But then you get to, after somebody got the mulberries rubbed in their face or something, then you'd laugh it off and have friends and go horse around and play baseball with them, wiffle ball. So I knew Whitey from, like, when we, you know, back in the same days when we were like 10, 12 years old. But then we started playing music and became very tight, you know. So that hurt when I lost Whitey, because that band was going to go. We put out that record.
Great record, yeah.
Yeah, and then had the good rooms, and then.
One of my favorite songs from the record is Sick and Tired. Can you talk about that?
Oh, yeah, super cool tune. In fact, I wasn't really aware of the song or that boned up on it, but they said, we want it. It's a rumba or a mambo. It's like a, play it like Professor Longhair. Well, that's all the guidance I needed.
Right.
And, I like to prepare, but I don't like to over-prepare. If you play stuff too much or too long, you just beat the life out of it. So I really hadn't heard the tune. I've done this too, record songs and you didn't really hear the song or the original, or you're all done with it, and then you go back and you hear what the original artist did with it, and you're like, oh wow, or oh gosh, I should have listened to that, you know. But what it was a B-flat mambo and play it like Professor Longhair. So that's what I did. I went in there, and the mix was so great, the engineer was so good, that they made me comfortable, and I nailed that in one take. So that was a success.
You gonna do? Oh, baby, what you gonna do? I'm sick and tired fooling around with you. Oh, well, I wake up in the morning, fix you something to eat. Before I leave for work, I even brush your teeth. I come home in the evening, you're still in bed. Got a rag tied around your head. Oh, baby,
what you gonna do? I'm sick and tired of fooling around with you. This is the last time I'm telling you to change your ways. Now listen to me, baby, believe what I said. Last time I'm telling you to stop that jive before you find yourself outside. Oh, babe, what you gonna do? I'm sick and tired fooling around with you. Come on, Molly. In the morning, fix you something to eat. Before I leave for work, I even brush your teeth. I come home in the evening, you're still in bed. Got a rag tied around your head. Oh, baby, what you gonna do? I'm sick and tired of fooling around with you. This is the last time I'm telling you to change your ways. Now listen to me, baby, believe what I said. Last time I'm telling you to stop that jive. Oh, you find yourself outside. Oh, baby, what you gonna do? I'm sick and tired fooling around with you.
Because, you know, don't you picture growing old with some of your better friends or musician friends, or you picture, well, I'm going to slow down eventually, but you don't, you know, or eventually I'm going to be doing the Geritol circuit. I'm going to be doing, I'll be doing, you know, the assisted living gigs or something.
Right.
You remember how to get a raise in the music business. You get rid of a member. You don't add a guy, you know.
Right.
So I'm going to, you know, thinking three-piece or two-piece, and eventually I'll be going solo, or I can see the writing on the wall. But he was a guy I pictured doing duos with.
Yeah.
And never happened.
So, I mean, I guess live for the moment and you get those gigs now.
Absolutely.
You know?
Yeah, you got to make hay while the sun shines. You just never know, you know. So, but that's blues.
Yep.
That's the blues. Builds character. What they say, life's what happens when you're busy making plans.
Can you talk about the writing process?
You know, it's very elusive writing a song. I do things kind of in cycles or bunches and binges, and frankly, I need to write more music. But the writing process for me is usually sitting at the piano and you like a combination of chords or a combination of voicing so that there is a melody within the chords. So I generally write chords first, but I've decided that I need to write a melody and reverse it and write a melody and stick the chords to it, almost simplify like a country song or have a nice sing-song melody and then worry about the chords later. I tend to write chords or fancy, you know, chords with three, four voices, or I can't help it, 13ths and ninths and all that, instead of just, let's write one with D, G, and A, or what have you, or maybe write it on the guitar instead of the piano. So I have made a goal to get back to writing. There's no correct formula,
no.
But for me, I would start with the chords. And I, like I said, I want to try to reverse that and have a melody first. Or I have had lyrics and then put chords to it. But
sometimes the lyrics will dictate a melody.
Now I'm writing sort of like poetry or lyrical ideas. I'm using the iPad and writing down a lot of ideas, starting with the words. No, normally that's not the way I wrote. I would generally come up with the piano or the chords, a solid set of chords, and then try to put some words to it. So But I'm not that prolific a writer. So like I says, I think I need to reexamine it, or there's nothing wrong with trying something completely different. So one of my goals is to start writing again because, you know, I've put out 3-4 records. I've been on numerous records as a sideman. But you put out an album and then somebody goes, well, when are you going to make the next one? And it's not something you do every day, or you do, even for me, annually.
It's a project.
It's a project, yeah. And it's a labor of love and so forth. But yeah, to me, if I put one out every 5 years or every 2 to 5 years, I would feel, yeah, I'm getting something done. So that being said, the writing process is very elusive to me. Let me just say, I'm not satisfied that I could be doing so much more. Or I hear stuff that's a hit, or hear stuff on the radio, and like, that's only got 3 chords. Or that's only got 1 chord. Or the lime and the coconut, you know, or the right. boogie or something.
Yeah.
But yeah, it doesn't have to be.
It doesn't have to be a masterpiece. Yeah.
It does not have to be that complicated to be quote unquote brilliant or to work, to move somebody. So
I like Norfolk Light Artillery Blues. I think it's pretty cool. It's sort of a blues with Steely Danish changes, and it's kind of the story of my life, but it was inspired by a marker at the Gettysburg Battlefield. I just looked at this marker for an artillery unit, the Norfolk Light Artillery Blues, and I'm like, what? It just hit me like a freight train because it was a Confederate unit wearing blue, right? So I said, oh, there's a song there, and then I wrote the words around it, and I had the hook first, which is a good thing because I couldn't tell you how many hooks I've really written. So that song has a cool story, I think, and it's basically a blues with Civil War overtones. Thank you.
you have a sure thing. But the fat lady didn't sing. You can never have a sure thing. God knows no fool. God knows no fool. God knows no fool.
What about the recording process? I mean, do you have a particular philosophy? Some guys like to go in and play live. Some guys work out parts. Or some guys like to create in the studio. How do you work in the studio?
Yeah, I generally create a lot of it in the studio. But there's something to be said when you have your band tight and you have your battle plan and you go in there and you nail 6 or 8 songs in one session. It's beautiful. But you can also go in there and kind of wing it, or you need it to kind of take on a life of its own, take you somewhere. Like, frankly, North-South, I had an engineer that had done a lot of work for and helped him get a B3 run, an M3 and a Leslie running and stuff. Well, he says, well, I owe you 5 songs, Wally, for all this help to get this organ and Leslie running and so forth. So that started, he likes it. You're going in the studio. Mm-hmm. You're making a record. And I'm like, whoa. So I did it all bass-ackwards the last time. Or I'd go in there, you'd have big aspirations or big plans, and the guys don't always achieve what you're picturing or visualizing. So you have to learn to coach it out or to tell people what bag you want or where you want
it
to go.
So you're the producer, too.
You are, yeah. At least in my case it was. So I even remember I did a session with Barry Spurdy many, many years ago, put piano on a rock and roll tune they wrote, and they told me, get the Oscar Peterson out of it, you know, or had to simplify. It was too jazzy. Or too busy, or too many chords, like 13th chords or whatever. It was just too jazzy. They said, get the Oscar Peterson out. Funny. Then we did another take, and I did exactly what he was looking for. So you just got to tell people what you're trying to do, or that's the beauty
they
of
it. They can't read your vision.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, right. So you need, or you luckily you can do extra takes and stuff, but the more takes you do on something, you don't really, I think it loses the life. I don't want it to be so tight. There's a fine line there, too. You want some spontaneity. Music, to me, has to have some interaction and some spontaneity. So you're better off to say, you know, well, it has these chords or this is the form, but then let the guy create the bass part or the drummer and you say, oh, I really like that or I don't like that. Instead of trying to I don't want to dictate exactly what people are going to play.
It's not a paint by numbers. It's let's throw some paint on the wall and make some art.
Yeah, right? And then we'll fix it over here. Right. You know, we'll put some outlining or some edging on it, yeah. So it's a different process, but I like to have it sort of morph or develop where it's going as you're doing it. You're not sure, you know, or there's songs that don't make the cut. Even on my record, I had one that I wasn't happy with it, and now I wished I'd have put it on.
Because you have the next one.
They put it on the next one, yeah, they'll never know. So there's no perfection, but I would like the band to have been tighter. I will say this, there's a lot of ways to do things. You could do the whole record yourself and overdub the parts. But I would, the next one, I want to have more, put the chord on, put the rhythm section, 3-4 guys, drums, bass, piano, or drums, bass, guitar, piano, put them all down at once, and you capture that feeling and that interaction.
Live feeling, yeah.
You do. And then you can overdub a sax solo or what have you, or the vocals, of course. You know, you might do scratch vocals and fix the vocals or something. But that way, I think you have more true about music having a life of its own. I don't believe in just everybody just put a layer, put another layer, put another layer. You know what can happen? You got to be careful. Okay, that song's a masterpiece, an audio studio masterpiece, let's say, even if it maybe not doesn't rank up there next to, Georgia on My Mind by Ray Charles or something. But it turned out really well. But can you pull it off live? Because you don't want to have something that you have on a record and you can't present it.
You have to be able to play it. You got to sell the record.
If you can't present it to an audience, then that's not really the best writing, in my opinion, or the best product.
So who's on the record? Who's in the Jeff Walworth band, JWB?
JWB is now, Tim Bednarik is my bass player, and we've locked in over the years where he does things that I really like and doesn't overplay, and we all learned about what works. He's my bass player, and he sings, and then the drummer is, of course, Tim has been in, knows everybody from the South Suburbs. He's been in so many bands and still. So him and I lock in and have been in a few different combinations. The drummer is Kevin Ruth. Everybody calls him Calbo. He's out of Joliet. And we used to back up T-Bird Huck in the 90s and play a lot of blues gigs. And he's a great pocket drummer. He's very busy, runs his own business, a Harley shop and so forth. But it's a solid rhythm section. And frankly, we don't gig enough because everybody's in other bands or everybody has day jobs and stuff. So I just retired. I'm very fortunate. But and then the lead player is Dean Bilkey, and he's a great player that's he's sort of a blues rock player, but the way we hooked up or connected immediately was we both loved the Allman Brothers. And they had a band where their keyboard player had a falling out. Actually, he worked with Jimmy Klecka is his name, and he worked with T-Bird also. So it was funny. I got out of T-Bird's band and got in the Cross-Eyed Cats with Dean Bilkey on guitar, and Klecka went and got back with Huck and took over my spot in Huck's band. It's funny how things go like that. Sometimes you swap drummers or swap bass players or what it may be. So I hooked up with Dean Bilkey in around 2000 playing Allman Brothers and Originals and Southern Rock and stuff, and ended up hooking him into my band. And JWB is just Wally World renamed, or the guys over the years said, well, it's kind of hard to take you seriously when you call it Wally World. So it served its purpose for many years, but we let that name go, and now it's JWB. And if you Google JWB, you might get rap guys, bands from overseas and so forth. So, but you put Jeff Walworth Band, and that's pretty unique. So I came up with JWB a few years back, and then I got in the Jaywalkers Band, which plays Southern rock and blues and the classic rock, if you will, Stones and so forth. But we don't worry about really what's on the hits on the radio now. But that's JWJB, Jaywalkers Jam Band. And I saw their logos got JW emblazoned on it like a tattoo. And I'm like, oh, okay, so I'm in JWB and I'm in JWJB. So I think it was meant to be.
You mentioned being a sideman. Any interesting stories about some different other performers that you've worked with?
Oh, absolutely. In the 90s, with Whitey and Bruce and a lot of those guys, local guys, start to go downtown, or you'd go down to the clubs, you know, way back in the day, you know, you'd go to Checkerboard. Haven't been there in years, or it reopened, right? And Buddy Guys and Kingston Mines and Roses and some of those. But mostly I'd stomp around Buddies in the 90s and 80s and 90s. And but anywho, I met Brother John Katke and George Bays, and they started to hire me out. And so then I was getting some gigs in the city and meeting a lot of the more well-known players. And I can't, you know, like, I don't know, Biscuit Miller, Carl Weathersby, Joanna Connor, she's a very nice person. And but at Buddy's, George Bays started hiring me. Rest in peace. Another guy gone. And he taught me Sissy Strut. That's when I think of him, I think of that jam. And Brother John played organ and guitar. And when he started playing guitar, he'd hire me to play keyboard. And it was nice enough. I actually get to play his M3, a small Hammond and a Leslie. And, man, was that an eye-opener. Because all the senses going. You're just – it was like a musical fix. You'd get so – invigorated I'd get up the next day, or I'd be good for 3 to 7 days, just like going and have your back cracked, or going. Right. I would be so invigorated after playing on a Hammond, you know. So somewhere in there, in the 90s, and that, I started to collect Leslies. So I always had Leslie speakers, and I had a pedal that you could plug in any quarter inch, so a guitar, a mic, you know, an organ, a synthesizer that sounds like an organ. Electric piano, anything, you could plug it through a Leslie instead of having these 6-pin, 9-pin, 11-pin weird cables that go on Hammond organs. So I always had Leslies and a synthesizer or some organ simulator, and people would come up to me and say, man, where's the B3? Or, man, that sounds just like a B3. And that was great. You know, that would make my day. So for years, I'd hauled around a Leslie, never had the Hammond organ. And Leslie was like my secret weapon. And over the years, less and less people want to screw around with it. You know, but I own 4 or 5, or I have a friend, Harry Zerbes, that learned a lot about working on organs and Leslies. And you learn stuff from everybody as far as keeping it running. And but he says, Wally, if you can't count your Leslies on one hand, you need therapy.
I was fortunate to have you play B3 on my record. And you really got excited when the oil started to heat up in that Leslie. And tell me about the
absolutely.
Tell me about that.
Hey, it's like when you smell the food cooking, the stew's almost ready, you know, or I can smell the chicken soup, it's done, it's cooked. When you're going right, or when your amps are warmed up, you probably know that you can feel some heat coming off your fenders and that smell and so
smells
forth.
Like an old television set.
Yeah. Exactly. So with a Leslie, it's a tube amp, and it has like 2 motors with another, it's 4 motors, 2 assemblies and pulleys and belts. You got to know how to work on them and keep them running, whether it's a fuses. You know, how many times do you see somebody rig tinfoil into a fuse cap or something when you didn't have a fuse in a jam, you know, or duct tape the fuse cap on with tinfoil? You know, so, but you learned how to, I first learned how to keep like the pulleys and motors running, and then learned about the amps and a little bit about tubes and working on the M3s and the organs. But when a Leslie's running good, it's like a car, keeping a car running, or you smell that oil. It just warms the cockles of the heart to me. Yeah, you know, to, you not only, you get done, you know, you smell the tubes, you smell the oil. If you're smelling oil, you know you're working that Leslie. Now, you don't want to get, they get hot. If the voltage isn't right, they get too hot. And you got to, it almost always is a motor that acts up, the top motor that's right. All the spinning, or on, off, on, off. I've worn out so many stomp boxes, foot switches from kicking it. I don't just leave it on slow chorale or on
you're
fast.
Working it, yeah.
I'm working it in certain sections of the song, on a solo or on the chorus, or if you lay it down, simplify under the singer or whatever. So who knows how many thousands of times I would stomp a stomp box before you'd wear the switch out. So you had to learn to work on your gear, or you're screwed. You can't put it in the shop every time something goes down. But yeah, happiness is a warm, odoriferous Leslie.
So hanging out at Buddy Guy's, you're playing with George Bays and Brother John. What did that lead into any other opportunities?
Oh, it sure did. I mean, luckily I was able back then. Buddy would hang out at the club a lot more. I don't think he was traveling the world quite as much. And on Sunday night and Monday night were the jam nights. And I met Buddy, and he's a nice guy. He'd hang out in the back and keep a somewhat low profile. And Junior Wells, and I got to jam with Junior Wells a couple, 3 times. He was a trip, but, man, he was the real deal.
Yeah.
It was, you know, you sat up and paid attention when he got a hold of the mic. And got to jam with him a couple different nights, and one time with Buddy. And they were really nice guys, and they were really – that made an impression of me. Most successful musicians will take the time to talk to up-and-coming musicians. And I was able to get a gig with Bo Diddley, I think, over the years. And no rehearsal or nothing. You just said you bone up on his material, and you go in there and you pay attention. You follow the leader.
That had to be fun.
Oh, it was great. And I'll never forget, you know, that side area where the VIP area, he was like eating a big plate of ribs right before he went on stage. Mm-hmm. Then wash the hands with a damp towel, or wipe your hands and face and go up there and nail it, you know. And that was an experience. So I'm very fortunate to get you log the miles, or you show up. What did Woody Allen say? 80% of life is showing up. And if you log enough miles in the clubs, hopefully you're going to finally break through and get some work. And Sun Seals was actually a direct offshoot from the Castle Rockers, or with Bruce Felgen, Glenn Wersbicki, Little Whitey, and that band. we got to warm up some acts and meet some of the people. And somehow, I think Where's Bicky and Mike Boyle even was a bass player for a while. Well, one of them had Sun Seal's connection. And
in Sun's later years, they worked with him, right?
Absolutely, and they needed a band. And when they couldn't get two guitars or when I could get away from the post office, I worked with them, and I was able to work about a year and a half or two with Sun. And you know what? Not only is the real deal and get exposed to the way blues is supposed to be played and how you present a song to an audience and so forth as far as a show, or to interact with the crowd, all of that stuff. But he was the nicest man. He was great. I couldn't believe he'd throw me a solo, and he'd nod and be grinning. He'd keep going. He'd, like, let me stretch out.
Right.
Some guys, you're lucky to get one rotation, or one or two verses, or two verses. You never get more than two verses. He would let me stretch out.
You mentioned backing up Sam Moore from Sam and Dave.
Oh, fantastic. What a nice man. Again, I not only remember the music and the artist, but I remember what kind of a person people were, you know. And 95% of people were just very gracious people. And that was a Barry Spurdy gig, or we were actually a part of sort of a doo-wop show or a Motown show. You get some of the better gigs at the casinos or some of the venues like that. It might have been a convention center out this way. But Barry Spurdy got the gig, and he needed a band. And you had to play charts, or you had to play the arrangements. There was not a lot of messing around there. You know, Hold On, I'm Coming, and when Something's Wrong with My Baby, yeah, and I Thank You, Wrap It Up.
Well, when I think about your playing, I think of, especially even listening to your record, I think, man, this is one of the most talented dudes that I know. And I know that you play more than piano and organ and saxophone. Can you talk about the other instruments? I mean, you're not just a keyboard player, you're a musician.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the compliment. Been called the color man, or I like to think of it like that. I've been lucky enough that when you sprinkle colors or flavors on top, you know. And so piano always first, and then organ. People had house organs, you know, growing up and stuff, but I was always a simulated organ. So piano and organ, I mean, that's my meat and potatoes. And I took up the sax about 14, 15, and then was able to learn the craft on the sax. I still got somewhere to go there. If you ever think you've got it figured out or everything, we can all improve. So never quit practicing. That's how I feel. You can always challenge yourself to do more. And slide guitar, I've always liked to doodle. I've always been kind of enamored or fascinated with slide guitar because it's like a voice. It just has so much soul. And so, you know, I heard Earl Hooker and Johnny Winter and, of course, Dwayne Allman, all that stuff. And always been kind of fascinated or partial to slide guitar. And so then I just started to try to do it, to learn it. And in fact, somewhere along the line, I got an old Gibson lap guitar. And so I mostly kind of like to play with it in my lap, like Dobro style. And I've also got a National guitar that I play on. And I start to discover different tunings. E tuning, of course, the main blues tuning. And then I discovered the sixth tuning. I think Mike Barker from Whitey's band showed me that for doing like Memphis, Tennessee, Sleepwalk, stuff mm-hmm. like that. It has more of a Hawaiian flavor sure. with a sixth chord. And then, you know, like Keith Richards, like I open G or open D and discovered some of that stuff. And it just creates these shapes or patterns that don't come up when you're in standard tuning. So I've always been fascinated with slide guitar. And I play some of that on the North-South record, some Dobro. It's an old National guitar. I call it a Dobro just because I play it Dobro style.
Right.
And they rebuilt it when they restored the guitar. They got it back from Applejack. That's another story. But the guy out in California, he put a maple neck instead of a rosewood neck. And I'm down with it, but it sounds a little brighter or a little more like a banjo, which I love the banjo. Someday I'm going to play
right.
one. You know, that's another instrument I have yet to take up. But anything I can get my hands on. So then the slide guitar, and I have a mandolin. And, of course, I can play bass or drums adequately. Clarinet, flute, you know, never violin. And harmonica baffles me. Now, if I had two grains of sense, I would have taken up the harmonica.
Instead,
of carrying around Leslie's and pianos and organs, you know. But, yeah, basically at this time, you know, I would say piano, organ, melodica, yep. which is a small keyboard. And you blow through it. So it's somewhere between a harmonica and a harp. It's got reeds. And then slide guitar, bass guitar, drums, percussion. I play percussion on the record, and again, rhythm, I'm a stickler about rhythm and patterns. If you're going to play percussion, play patterns. Don't take a solo through the whole song.
Right.
I don't need that. You know, we don't need that. Simplify, you know. And then flute and sax. So Yeah, I haul around a lot of gear, you know.
Hey, let's make some music right now.
All right, let's do it.
Well, seize my key. Took my baby out of school. Yeah, I could be wrong. I took my baby out of school. Cadillac car.
said, ho, 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 skillet. Now jump. Get that Fendil Cadillac car.